All right, well, we're going to get into our verse-by-verse study of Job. We've gone through the central themes of Job and some of the great themes of Job. So turn, if you will, to Job chapter 1. And we're going to talk tonight about his accuser and adversary. So obviously, we're going to talk about the Satan tonight. And, you know, this is relevant because Satan is also our accuser and our adversary. He continues the same work that he was doing in the book of Job today. So we're going to spend a couple of sessions looking at what Satan is trying to do and really get to the heart of the book of Job. So we need to really understand Satan's challenge to God, and that's what we're going to do tonight and next week. We need to understand what Satan says about Job and, by extension, all of mankind. But we met Job in chapter 1, verses 1 through 5, and I just want to go quickly through those verses again to remind you of who Job was. We did this verse by verse. But it says, "There was a man in the land of Uz whose name was Job, and that man was blameless and upright." And we know that means that he was straightforward and he had integrity, and one who feared God and shunned evil. And 7 sons and 3 daughters were born to him. Also his possessions were 7,000 sheep, 3,000 camels, 5,000 yoke of oxen, 500 female donkeys, and a very large household. So that this man was the greatest of all the people in the east. And his sons would go and feast in their houses, each on his appointed day, and would send and invite their 3 sisters to eat and drink with them. So it was, when the days of feasting had run their course, that Job would send and sanctify them, and he would rise early in the morning and offer burnt offerings according to the number of them all. For Job said, "It may be that my sons have sinned and cursed God in their hearts." And this Job did regularly. So we saw that Job was an upright man, that he was sincere, he was righteous, he was not sinless. We know that. He confesses his sin later on. But he had integrity. And when he said something, you could trust him to mean what he says and to follow through with it. That word actually meant if you did a business dealing with someone, you could trust them. So Job is described here. We now meet, or are going to meet, the adversary. And I want you to understand something about Satan, because I'm sorry Teresa's not here tonight. You need to tell her she needs to listen, because a couple of the questions that she has asked have been very, very good, and we're going to cover them tonight. First of all, we need to understand what Satan's role is right now. Okay? Satan's role right now is he is not in the eternal hell. What is he doing now? He's roaming around where? On the earth. That's right. So Satan was cast out of heaven to earth, but not permanently. We're going to see that. There's coming a time when it will be permanent. We will see that in the book of Revelation. In fact, Revelation 12, verse 10 tells us, "Then I heard a loud voice saying in heaven, now salvation and strength and the kingdom of our God and the power of his Christ have come. For the accuser of our brethren, who accused them before our God day and night, has been cast down." So that is a time that is completely coming. Right now, Satan is roaming, and we'll see a little bit more. But right now, as you guys said, he is prowling the earth like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. So we need to understand that he is a real adversary. He is not a little guy with a pitchfork tail and a little red costume running around. If you will remember who he was created as Lucifer, the light bearer, the beautiful one. The Bible actually says he was the most beautiful angel ever created. But remember, he was an angel created. So let's play a little game. I know some of you have done this before. I'm going to say a word, you tell me the opposite. You ready? Day. Night. Light. God. I heard Satan. Wrong. The opposite of God is nothing. There is no opposite of God. God was never created. God always was. The opposite of the devil is Michael, the archangel. That's all Satan was. And we need to remember that, which tells us a little bit about him. While he is our adversary, He is a created being. Who created him? And let's get more specific. Which member of the Trinity created him? Jesus Christ. Really all of them, but Jesus is the one that created. Through him all things were created, we're told. So the devil, Lucifer, was created by God, by Jesus specifically, to be the chief musician in heaven. The Bible tells us that when he walked, his body was like a harp or a lyre. He would make music simply by walking and moving. What was his sin? He wanted to be higher than God. We call that pride. He had the five eyes. I'm going to lift my kingdom higher than the Lord. I will sit higher than the Most High. I will be exalted. I. Five times in Isaiah 14. So need to understand, because that tells you something about him. So if he wants to be God, but he can't be, what kind of feeling do you think he has toward God? Hate, resentment, yeah, hate, resentment, what else? Anger, jealousy, all great answers and all correct, and you're going to see each one of those tonight. You're going to see anger, hate, jealousy, and resentment. And you're going to hear it right off the bat. Because I can't convey the tone, but I think you can hear the tone. And when we start hearing Satan talk back to God, I want you to think about the most insolent teenager you've ever had talk back to you in your life. Or, if you're young, one of your friends that's talking back to you. So, but that's what I want you to think about. So let's pick up. I want to read verses 6 through 12. That's as far as we'll get tonight. We've met Job. Now it says, now there was a day when the sons of God, that refers to the angels, came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. And the Lord said to Satan, from where did you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth and from walking back and forth on it. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil? Here comes Satan. So you got the tone in your voice? You ready to hear it? So Satan answered the Lord and says, does Job fear God for nothing? Have you not made a hedge around him, around his household, and around all that he has on every side? You've blessed the work of his hands, and his possessions have increased in the land. But stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Then the Lord said to Satan, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So Satan went out from the presence of the Lord. You hear the tone in that? So you need to remember the overall theme of Job. The overall purpose, as you get back into these verses, is that the glory of God is more important than our comfort. The glory of God is the most important thing in the world. Isaiah 43:7 tells us that we are created for the glory of God. Not to have a comfortable life, not to make a lot of money, not to do anything else, but we are created for the glory of God, pure and simple. So that it matters in the world that there is a man given us as an example in the Bible who worships God simply because he's God. Who worships God without being blessed, not because of his blessings, that simply because God is worthy of worship. So God gives us this example of Job, who lost more money, more riches, more family, lost more everything than we all will probably ever have. That's why the Bible tells us who Job was and all of his possessions. We need to recognize how much God took from him. And you're going to see that. God allowed to be taken from him. Let me put it that way. And Satan is continuing this same challenge today. You know what he says today? Look back at these verses. Today he says, Does blank not fear you for anything? Have you not prospered him or her? And he says to the people, he says, you know, if God really loved you, you'd have all this stuff. You'd have all the money you wanted. You'd have all the health. You'd never have pain. You'd never have suffering. So he lies to God and he lies to us. And he accuses us of things that we don't do. And he accuses us of things that we've been forgiven of. He accuses us of things that God will never, ever, ever bring up. And then Satan, in his smart mouth way, challenges God. He says, you know what? If you put Job to the test, he won't love you anymore. In fact, look at verse 11. If you stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, he will surely curse you to your face. Now we know that doesn't work. Satan comes back. We'll see next week in chapter 2, verse 4 and 5. And, you know, he ratchets it up a little bit. He goes back to God and he says, well, okay. You know, yeah, he didn't curse you, but that was just stuff. And he actually says over in chapter 2, verse 4, skin for skin. Yes, all that a man has, he will give for his life. So stretch out your hand now and touch his bone and flesh, and he will surely curse you to your face. That was what Satan wanted. Why did Why did Satan want Job to curse God to his face? Yes. Why? Resentment, anger, jealousy, all those things you all said. All those things, he cannot take us from God. He wants to destroy our witness. Does God grieve when we sin? Does God grieve when we stay away from church for a while? Does God grieve when we drop out of fellowship? Does God grieve when we don't follow his commandments? Yeah, all those things are true. And you know, we do a lot of that ourselves, but Satan's behind much of it. Satan's the tempter. Satan's the accuser. And that's what he's trying to do. But God knew what Job would do. And that's why this book is in here, folks. God wanted to record someone who had more than most of us will ever know. Had it all stripped away, Satan issues this challenge that basically is the prosperity gospel today. He issues this great challenge, and you said, you take away everything he's got, he's going to curse you. He only loves you because of what you give him. And God says, bring it on. Okay? God says, bring it on. So let's go through this. You get the whole gist of what's going on? And there's a couple of points you're going to see tonight that people have trouble with. People have trouble with the fact, well, we'll get to that. People have trouble first with verse 6. Let's look at verse 6. Now there was a day when the sons of God came to present themselves before the Lord, and Satan also came among them. This is one of the first questions that Teresa asked, and it's a great question. I thought God could not be in the presence of evil. So how could Satan come before God? That's a good question, and we need to deal with that. Let me tell you how that happened. Number one, if you read this verse in its original language, it says, now there was a day when God summoned all the angels. So God summons everyone. Are you going to be able to refuse a summons from the Lord God? No, you're not. So why was Satan able to come? Because God demanded that he be present. And yeah, basically subpoenaed, yeah. He demanded that he be present. So that one's pretty easy. Did he have a right to enter God's presence? All we know is that when God summons, he responded. Because remember, he is still a created thing. And even we've already seen that God had to give him permission to touch anything that Job had. Because remember when Satan goes, well, you put a hedge of protection around him. God didn't say, oh, well, no, I didn't. Did y'all catch that? God, and that's what Job prayed for. Job prayed that his family would be protected. We can pray for that same hedge of protection. and God will put it to rest. Doesn't mean sometimes he'll let it go. But understand that Satan is responsive to God. So I know we talked a little bit then. The second question is, what's Satan doing now? We talked a little bit about the fact that he's prowling the earth like a roaring lion, seeking whom he may devour. Paul described him in Ephesians 12:2 as the prince of the power of the air, the spirit who now works in the sons of disobedience. So understand what this concept is. He is the prince of this world. He's not the king. Who's the king? Jesus. But he is the prince. We see him in Zechariah chapter 3, verses 1 to 2. This is another time when he's acting as the accuser. Zechariah 3, verses 1 to 2. It says, "Then he showed me Joshua, the high priest," and I want you to look where Satan is, "standing before the angel," cap A, angel of the Lord, that's Jesus, "and Satan standing at his right hand to oppose him. And the Lord said to Satan, 'The Lord rebuke you, Satan. The Lord has chosen Jerusalem.'" Okay? So he's up there and he is accusing Joshua, the high priest, of sin. That's what he's doing with you and me. Did you hear what Parks did today? Did you see what this man who calls himself a child of God did today? Did you see what Janelle did today? Did you see what Keith did today? All these things, he says. You know what Jesus says? "I got him. I got her." But he's up there constantly, day and night. And we need to understand that his power is real. I want to take you back. Turn over to Matthew chapter 4, verse 8 and 9. This is the story of Jesus' temptation in the desert. I want you to not miss something about this. So, you know, the devil's tempted him. You know, "Hey, you want something to eat? I know you're hungry. Just turn this rock into bread. You'll be good." But at this temptation in verse 8 and 9 of chapter 4, it says, "Again, the devil took him," Jesus, "up on an exceedingly high mountain and showed him all the kingdoms of the world and their glory. And he said to him, 'All these things I will give you if you will fall down and worship me.'" So, what do you think about that verse? First time you read that, you go, how's that possible? I mean, Jesus created the world. Jesus created the kingdoms.
How?
Huh?
Adam's lost the keys. Mm-hmm.
See, the devil actually has that power. He is the power of the prince of this air. He could give those kingdoms of the world to Jesus. Jesus didn't say, "You idiot, move away. You don't have that power." What did Jesus say? "You shall not tempt the Lord your God." But understand the power really that Jesus has. Satan is given power for a time. We know how Satan's power will end. We know how Satan's power has already been defeated. That happened on the cross and through the resurrection. But we understand, we need to understand he's real. Because that makes Job so much more understandable. Jesus said in John 12, "Now is the judgment of this world. The ruler of this world," referring to Satan, "will be cast out." So Satan rules the world now. Paul says in Ephesians, "For we do not wrestle against flesh and blood, but against principalities, against powers, against the rulers of the darkness of this age, against spiritual hosts of wickedness in the heavenly places." Ephesians 6:12. So we just need to understand he's real. So that's one issue. The second issue that Teresa raises, you know, how can he come into the presence of God? Well, he was summoned. We talked about that. But a lot of people have this idea, and it's based on an Old Testament scripture, that God cannot look on evil. How many of you heard of that? All right. Well, and that's true. We need to understand what it means, look on evil. Okay. So Habakkuk 1:13 says, "You are of purer eyes than to behold evil and cannot look on wickedness." So you cannot look on wickedness. Anybody see a problem with simply saying that that verse means that God cannot look on sinful people?
Yes.
All right, what's the problem?
Look at me.
Absolutely. Absolutely. Everyone should see that. Jesus came not only to look on sinful people, He came to live with sinful people. He spent every single day of His life with sinful people. Okay, what was His goal? To deal with their sin. But He did not come in a way that prohibited Him from physically looking at them. That would be silly, right? God looks at us. He looks at each one of us and He sees our sinful nature and He says, I love you, you need my son. What this verse means is God cannot look with affection, cannot look pleasingly, cannot look affectionately on wickedness. He's not going to look with approval on wickedness. It doesn't mean He physically cannot look at wickedness. Otherwise, He wouldn't be God either. That's a major point. But Gary's is the better one. Does that make sense, everybody? Okay. Matthew 5:45 tells us that He makes the sun rise on the evil and on the good and sends rain on the just and the unjust. So He is doing all those things for both of us, both groups of people, the just and the unjust. And so He can look upon sin. Why did He turn His back on Jesus on the cross? Nope. Because Jesus became sin for us, and God cannot look with approval on sin. So the Son whom He loved for all those years, for eternity, became sin. Understand how dramatic this is. He became sin, and God could not behold with approval His own Son. Does that hit home? I mean, we got to get the cross back up there. I keep pointing to it. It's not there. You know that would have been painful physically. But imagine if you're Jesus Christ, who you've spent your entire lifetime with the Father, and all of a sudden He won't even look at you because He can't. He's too holy to look at His own Son with any kind of approval whatsoever. He saw Him on the cross. He's not looking at Him with love. It pleased God to wound Him for our transgressions, to put all of our sin on Him, to punish Him who did no wrong. So I think that's what a lot of people think, that, you know, God can't look on evil. We have to look beyond that to get across the point of, well, how can Satan be in heaven? Number one, we know he can go because God summoned him. Number two, there's no theological prohibition on him going, because God can look at evil, just not with approval. God does not approve anything Satan's going to do. But he certainly can be in his presence for a while. Again, we know how that one's going to end, as does Satan. So God is capable of being God in the presence of sin. That's what's different. You know, when we're sinners, we don't have the capability of being anything else apart from Jesus Christ. We're simply sinners. If we have Jesus Christ, then we have the capability of being righteous in the presence of sinners. Right? Okay. All right. So, the other thing, the next part in verse 7 is the part a lot of people, the second part a lot of people have trouble with. It says, and the Lord said to Satan, from where have you come? So Satan answered the Lord and said, from going to and fro on the earth, walking back and forth on it. So who started this conversation? God. Do you think God knew where this conversation was going to go?
Yes.
Uh-huh. You want to be Job right now? No. And then here it goes. Then the Lord said to Satan, have you considered my servant Job, that there is none like him, on the earth, a blameless and upright man, one who fears God and shuns evil. So God asks for Satan's report. What you been doing? I've been going to and from on the earth. God says, well, well, he was. What's his job? Seeking whom he may devour.
And he knew there was an edge, so clearly he had tried to get a job.
Oh, yes. Yeah, you start to understand this because Satan knows when you've got the armor of God.
Mm-hmm.
But God brings it up. Anybody have trouble with that? That's exactly what's going on. Maybe not trying to get one at Satan, but trying to give one to us. Because, again, Satan's whole premise, as we're getting ready to see, God knows what's getting ready to happen. God knows exactly what's getting ready to come out of Satan's mouth. So, if you're going to pick somebody to let Satan challenge by taking everything away and see if he will curse God and die, you know, that's what my goal is, Satan says. And God invites him. Well, have you thought about Job? Could he say that about us? Have you considered Jonas today? You consider Wilma today? That would be tough, wouldn't it? Some people have trouble with the fact that God initiates this. Why did God create us? We've got to come back. All right, God knows how this story's going to end, right? Does God get glory out of the entire book of Job? Yes. Did Job ever follow his wife's advice and curse God and die?
No.
Did Job ever curse God to his face? So what did Satan do in this little battle of wits with the Lord?
He lost,
right? And that's the message. And we take solace from this. But here's the tough part. God allowed Job to suffer for his glory.
God is God. We're here at his will
for pleasure. I agree. And we say that. Do you believe that? Because if you don't, when the suffering comes, and it will come, you will not be able to hold on to this truth. You have to understand that God is doing exactly what Lauren said. He is giving us an opportunity to suffer so that he will be glorified. Very tough lesson. I want to take you to a couple of places in the Bible where this happens. John chapter 9. John chapter 9, verse 1 says, Now as Jesus passed by, he saw a man who was blind from birth. And his disciples asked him, saying, Rabbi, who sinned, this man or his parents, that he was born blind? See, that was the Eastern religion belief, karma. You sinned, you're going to get paid for it. You're going to get payback. So who sinned? Was it him or was it his father? Jesus answered in verse 3, Neither this man nor his parents sinned, but that the works of God should be revealed in him. This man was blind from birth. We don't know how long he had laid there. We don't know how old he was, but he was blind from birth so that God's glory could be demonstrated. So, God let him be born blind. You okay with that? I hope you are. The potter makes the clay into whatever he wants to make it. You know, the Romans, Paul writes, he says, the teacup doesn't turn around and go, why'd you make me like this? Your kids ever, maybe you guys did this in school, y'all ever make those... We used to make ashtrays. Nobody smoked, but we always made ashtrays or little plates or something and brought them home. We were so proud of them. Y'all ever do that? Your kids ever do that? No? Okay. That's an old thing, I guess. But anyway, you bring it home, you're so proud of this, you look at it, and of course now you look back at it and go, oh, that was the ugliest thing I've ever seen. But we would never tell our kids that. But we do that. Our mother loved it, you know. It's like we made a teacup. We can't just raise our arm and go, God, why'd you make me a teacup? Paul says we need to understand that God makes some vessels for glory, some for other lowly functions, some for dishonor. But he makes us the way that he wants us to be. So why was the blind man blind until the moment that Jesus walked by? Because it was Jesus' appointed duty that day to heal that blind man in the presence of everyone so that that blind man can testify and give glory to God. If you read on in chapter 9, we won't do it, but the Pharisees and the scribes, they kept trying to challenge him. Well, you know, who was this guy? He goes, I don't know. Then they go to his parents. Well, how did this happen? They're like, I don't know, ask him. In verse 23, they say, therefore his parents said, he's of age, ask him. So they called again the man who was blind and said to him, we know this man is a sinner. You need to give God the glory. And here's what he said. This is a great testimony in verse 25. He answered and said, whether he is a sinner or not, I don't know. One thing I know, I was blind, but now I see. You see that testimony? It's that simple. He gave God the glory. Go over to John chapter 11. So we see that one where Jesus allowed this man to be born blind in order that he could demonstrate the love of God and the glory of God. In John chapter 11, we read the story of Lazarus. And I want you to understand something about this one. So we understand in verse 1, there was a certain man who was sick, Lazarus of Bethany, and that was where Mary and Martha, his sister, lived. Jesus loved this whole family, we know. The sisters in verse 3 sent to him and said, Lord, behold, he whom you love is sick. Now, when you get the message that someone you love is sick, what do you immediately do? You drop everything, you rush to their side, right? Well, let's see what Jesus did. When Jesus heard that, he said, this sickness is not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of God might be glorified through it. Okay, so naturally, verse 6, when he heard that Lazarus was sick, he stayed 2 more days. He didn't drop everything and run back. Then after 2 days, he said to his disciples, let us go to Judea again. They brought up the fact that they were trying to kill him, and he said, no problem. Verse 11, he says, after that, our friend Lazarus sleeps, but I go that I may wake him up. And naturally, one of the disciples says, well, Lord, if he sleeps, he'll get better. However, Jesus spoke of his death. The disciples still didn't understand. So Jesus said to them plainly, Lazarus is dead. So Jesus delayed, and Lazarus died. Jesus delayed intentionally, knowing what was going to happen, right? Look at this next verse. And I am glad for your sakes that I was not there. I am glad for your sake that I was not there to heal him. I am glad for your sake that he died. Very tough lesson. But we understand what's going on, so let's go on over. He goes over in verse 24, he's talking to Martha. Verse 23, he says, your brother will rise again. Martha says, I know that he will rise again in the resurrection at the last day. She was a believer. Jesus said to her, here's the lesson. I am the resurrection and the life. He who believes in me, though he may die, he shall live. And whoever lives and believes in me shall never die. Do you believe this? She said, yes, I do. So Jesus goes over and he says, where have you laid him? They tell him, he takes away the stone. Verse 40, Jesus says, did I not say to you that if you would believe, you would see the glory of God? This is what they're getting ready to see. Then they took away the stone from the place where the dead man was laying, and Jesus lifted up his eyes and said, listen to this prayer, Father, I thank you that you have heard me, and I know that you always hear me. But because of the people who are standing by, I said this, that they may believe that you sent me. Jesus said back in verse 4 that the sickness was not unto death, but for the glory of God, that the Son of Man would be glorified through it. So he cried with a loud voice, Lazarus, come forth. What happened? Lazarus came forth, stumbling out of the tomb. And what, did Jesus get glory? Oh, yes, he did. Did God get glory? Oh, yes, he did. Got so much glory that the Pharisees and the scribes tried to kill him and Lazarus. This really ratcheted things up, because everywhere Lazarus went, do you think he had a pretty good testimony? There's a great song by Greater Vision. It's called My Name is Lazarus. Anybody ever heard that? It's about these four guys that carried the stretcher in. It's kind of made up. Well, it is kind of made up, because we don't know who any of those four guys were. But guy number one says, well, you know, I was lame and Jesus healed my leg, but this is more serious than that. And the other guy says, well, yeah, I was kind of paralyzed or something and Jesus healed me of that. And the other guy said, well, I was blind and Jesus kind of healed me of that. And they all turn but you know, I don't think he can do this, because this is more serious. Then they all turn to this fourth guy and he goes, my name is Lazarus. Let me tell you what happened to me. And I'm like, okay, end of story. It's a great song. Listen, My Name is Lazarus by Greater Vision. Free plug for them. But anyway, so we need to understand that God is doing this whole exchange with Satan for his glory. And God will use us for his glory. And God will use our suffering for his glory. And we have to ask ourselves when we go through suffering, what's up, God? Instead of saying, get me out of this right now, or why are you putting me through this in that tone, ask, God, how can I glorify you in this suffering? How can I bring glory to you when I'm broken, when I'm upset, when I've lost a loved one, when I'm sick, I've gotten this bad diagnosis? How can I bring glory to you? There was a lady at my old church, I may have told you this, but, you know, she was really studying and doing really good, getting closer to God, and she got a cancer diagnosis. And I was talking to her, and I gave her this book, and I said, you know, every question you ask is coming up right now. Everything you ever wanted to know, you're getting ready to see firsthand. And she got upset at first. But at her funeral, you know what she wanted people to hear? The gospel of Jesus Christ. She wanted everybody to hear what God had done in her life. No sadness, no nothing. This is what God did in my life, and I want him to do it in yours. Despite cancer, despite leaving two kids and a loving husband, she wanted them to hear the gospel of Jesus Christ. That's how you glorify God through suffering. It's not a pity party. You're going to hear Job. Job, you know, we give him a lot of credit. You know, the patience of Job is referenced in the New Testament. But he kind of gets a little direct. He questions God at the beginning. And you know what he ends up concluding? We looked at this a little bit. He ends up concluding, hey, my mouth is shut. I got nothing to say. I'm not you, God. I realize that. I'm going to shut my mouth. So that's what's going on. Verse 9 then, let's go back to Job. So we know that Satan is intending evil on Job. We know from Genesis 50 verse 20, we know from Romans 8, 28 that God means it all for good, right? So how's it going to turn good? How's it going to be good for Job that he suffers? It's going to be good for Job because Job is given the opportunity opportunity of the entire Bible to glorify God, because he's given every opportunity to curse God. Everything he holds dear is taken away. And then his buddies come over and they blame him. Well, you've got to have sinned. That's the same thing they said about the blind man in John. You must have sinned. You're just lying. You're not telling us the truth. Something's going on. Fess up. He goes, I don't. I would if I did. I know I've sinned. I've confessed those. And then he gives us that great gospel testimony about knowing his Redeemer lives and we'll see him again. So God offers Job to be tested, to be persecuted, to undergo suffering. What did Jesus say about us? Don't think it strange when you suffer persecution, because if they punish the master, they're going to do the same thing to the servant. Peter talked about suffering, and Peter and Paul both said, you know, we just count this light affliction. Understand what the Christian persecution was in 64 AD. They were hunting down Christians because Nero had blamed the fire in Rome on them. They were killing Christians. They went into the Colosseum. They were lion bait. All right? We talk about Christian persecution in the U.S. today. We don't know what that word means. You go over to India. You go over to Pakistan. You go over to Ecuador. I don't know if I told you all this or not. There was a fellow in Ecuador who became a Christian, went home, told his family, they stoned him in the 21st century. He survived. They left him for dead. And it was all because he had become a Christian. That's what real persecution is. That's what the beheadings are going on in Asia today. And that's what God does. You remember the picture of those guys that were all lined up along the river. This was probably 10, 15 years ago, and ISIS beheaded them. They had the black hoods on their faces, and they told them simply, renounce Christ, renounce God, and you will live. They were all praying as they were beheaded. ISIS did that to discourage people from believing in God. What happened? It strengthened. When they broadcast that testimony of those dying fellows, whoa, Christianity rose, because people understood God's using us for His glory. And they get that. We don't get that. We got this comfort thing going on. We think we're here for ourselves, and we're not. And we got to get over that. When we really understand that we're here to be used by God no matter what it costs, We're bought. You know that? We were bought with a price. We are no longer His. Not our spirit, not our body. We're no longer ours. We're His. So He can do with us what He wants. And unlike, you know, the teacup, we're not going to sit there and yell back at Him. We're going to be sitting there going, yes, Lord, what do You want? Send me wherever You want to send. Do what You want to do. Bring glory through me. So God does that. God offers Satan the bait. And Satan, out of resentment, anger, bitterness, jealousy, he took the bait. Look in verse 9. So Satan answered the Lord and said, well, Job doesn't fear You for nothing. You've made a hedge around him, around his household, around all that he has on every side. You've made it so easy for him to love You. You've blessed the work of his hands. His possessions have increased throughout the land. So here's what Satan says. Does Job really love You? Does this sound familiar? Sounds kind of like the question he asked Eve, doesn't it? Does Job really love You because You're God? Or does Job just love You because of what You've given him? Will a person love God just because He's God? And then verse 11. The challenge. But now stretch out your hand and touch all that he has, and he will surely curse you to your face. Eat of the apple, you shall not surely die. But he's talking to God now, not Eve. And God says, behold, all that he has is in your power. Only do not lay a hand on his person. So God granted Satan power over his possessions. everything that Satan was given that mantra about. He only loves you because all the stuff you gave him. God says, okay, take it all away. You can do what you want to with it. Just don't touch his person. Because remember, Satan hadn't got there yet. That's next conversation. But everything Job has was placed in Satan's hands. God permitted him to take it all away. So lots of lessons we can take from just that one verse. Number one, if Satan is going to attack you and you are a child of his, does he need God's permission? Yes. Can God equip you to defeat Satan? How does he do that? Ephesians 6, the armor of God. We did this last year at VBS. Anybody remember the VBS armor? Helmet of salvation. Breastplate of righteousness. Good. Okay. Good. It's the belt of truth. Sword of the Spirit, which is the word of truth. And the shield of faith. You visualize that armor. Put it on every day. God's there. And that armor will help you stand against the wiles of the devil. That's what we're promising. We're just there to stand. And the imagery is that Roman soldier. We had Isaiah dress up like this. The Roman soldier with those 6-inch spikes in his feet in sand. He's not going to slide. He's ready. He's ready for the battle. The only offensive weapon, remember, is the word, sword of the Spirit, which is the word of God. So as we leave this, we need to understand God's in charge of all of this. To say that Satan did this on his own is to take away the glory of God. It is a wrong reading of Scripture. You cannot get away from the fact that God is the one who arranges this trial for Job. You cannot get away from that. Now, he used Satan, who used the Chaldeans, who used these guys that marauded and attacked. He allowed tornadoes to come through. He did all the, you know, let all this stuff happen. God didn't do any of it, but he allowed Satan to do it. And when we get that picture, we understand the true purpose of Job. God works all things according to the counsel of his will. And he knew what was going to happen, and he knew that sitting here 4,000 years later, we're going to be going through suffering. We're going to be going through hard times. We're going to ask the question, God, why is this happening to me? Why did this happen to me? And it is because God is giving you an opportunity to glorify him. Look, I know some of you have been through some bad things. You're sitting here tonight, and God is giving you that opportunity to glorify him even through it. And he's given you an opportunity to relate to people that you can only relate to because of those things that you went through. Can you imagine Job after he, you know, we know God restores him twofold and gives him more than he ever had at the very end. That's for those of you that read the last chapter. We know that happens. Can you imagine Job's testimony? We know that Moses got this book about 800 years later, the parts that are written with the exact conversations. So Job thought enough about it to tell people about it, write it down, do something, so it got to Moses. And I can just imagine Job's testimony. Well, you know, I didn't know what God was doing, but I saw his blessing all through it. Just like the blind man. I don't know why I was born blind, but man, when I saw Jesus, and I know he healed me. I was blind, but now I see. Lazarus. Can't get much better than that. I was dead. As Martha said, he stinketh. You know, I've been in there 4 days. But now I'm alive again. And here's your testimony. Here's the testimony you can share. I was dead in my sin and trespasses. I was as dead as Lazarus was physically, and he called me out. Parks, come forth. He called me out to salvation. And now I am alive forever. That's the testimony each person in here who has accepted Jesus Christ should have. And Jesus promises us that we will go through hardships. He says, you know, you're going to suffer hardships in the world. Do not fear. I have overcome the world. So that is the message of Job tonight. Satan is going to be our accuser. He's going to be our adversary, just like he was with Job. He's going to challenge us like he did with Job. Sometimes God will let him. Who do you think learned the biggest lesson from this? You think Job? It's either us or Job. I guess it could be Satan. But, I mean, don't we get comfort from this story, as bad as it is for Job? I mean, we should get comfort. We should understand that God's going to let this happen, but if he does, it's only for his glory. And we just have to figure out how. And ask God how, because a lot of times we won't see. It's hard to see when something hurts. How could this possibly be used for God's glory? But he promises us that all things will work together for our good, and that all things will work in the counsel of his will, and all things will glorify him. Okay? All right. Anybody got any?